Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we certainly can reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. And welcome back. I'll start today's show by reading from the Good Old Days magazine, the letter from the editor. She says, "Is it just me, or does it seem like time sure flies for you too? Yes, I know, time flies when you're having fun. That would be true for me because I've been having the most fun being the editor of Good Old Days for 2 years now. I truly enjoy all your memories, whether it be reading a tale from your past or seeing the photos that add to your life story. In this issue, we're happy to share memories of how your families got along during the hard times. Families remained close and loving and depended on each other no matter what. We also have stories about spring dances and events, opening the windows to freshen up spaces after long winters, spring cleaning tasks, mowing the grass, and more. Plus, you shared memories of Easter with the family at church, breaking bread together around the table, and hunting for colorful eggs. Speaking of getting together for Easter, we're happy to introduce you to our new Good Old Days in the Kitchen contributor, Jennifer Broadstreet Hess. We think you will enjoy both the story she wrote about Easter with her own family and the recipes she shares. I look forward to seeing what else she brings to the table for us all. Welcome to the Good Old Days family, Jennifer. And thanks to all our loyal readers. You are very much appreciated. Signed, Kathy Lynch, Editor, Good Old Days Magazine." We'll start today's reading with a delightful story about a little girl and her grandfather. It's entitled The Legend of Sugar Brown. She learned life lessons spending time with her grandfather. This was sent in by Doris Matlock. "I was on Grandpa's porch when I heard an unusual sound coming down the gravel road. I ran over to the fence to greet the approaching sound. My 6-year-old eyes grew wide with excitement as I saw a farm wagon that had rubber tires instead of iron rims like our wagon. 'Grandpa, Grandpa!' I yelled. He joined me at the fence and together we watched the scene. In the driver's seat was a man holding the reins of 2 big black horses. Their bridles were colorful and ornate. Sitting next to the man was a stately lady. She looked strangely beautiful to me. The wagon passed us by with horses prancing as the driver flicked his whip high over their heads. He had a smug smile on his face. 'Grandpa, I have a question. Is the wagon driver named Sugar Brown, or is that his mother's name?'
'His mother's name is Sugar Brown. Her son is Billy Brown. I've met them down at the store, and we talked a good while. Billy is very friendly. His mother is quiet, but always holds a regal position when sitting or standing.'
'Regular position? What's that, Grandpa?' I asked.
'Never mind. I just mean she sits straight and tall and looks sort of like a queen. She doesn't talk much,' Grandpa said. He continued, 'The story goes that her family raised sugarcane. When she was a little girl, making syrup from sugarcane was fascinating to her. She would always have her little bucket ready when the first drops of that amber juice dripped from the homemade spout. She would stick her fingers into the bucket until her mama came and took her and the bucket out of the way. Soon everyone started calling her Sugar Brown instead of Sarah Brown, which is her given name. My curiosity was satisfied for the moment as Grandpa and I returned to the front porch of his big old farmhouse. My grandpa, Levi Patterson Dunn, was the Justice of the Peace for our county in Oklahoma, and in my mind, that was right next to the president or sheriff or some other high-up person. He did hold court over people for fighting or stealing cattle or some other mean thing like that. His so-called office was in his living room, where he had a big desk covered with lots of papers. He was a mighty important person in my eyes. A bit later, the same day we saw the Browns pass by on their wagon, Grandpa and I walked the quarter mile to the old country store. Occasionally we went there for supplies and chocolate drops and peppermint sticks. As we walked, I mused. Boy, oh boy, wouldn't it be nice to have rubber tires on our wagon when we ride on these rocky dirt roads? Then Grandpa continued telling me about Sugar Brown.
The story about Sugar Brown is that she migrated here from New Orleans many years ago. Her reputation is less than favorable, as they say, because she's so secretive and not very neighborly. Stories about loud parties, voodoo practices, and illegal goings-on are told, but I don't believe any of it. As the Justice of the Peace, I have to be fair and impartial, and this is what I found out. That brave lady is actually doing a great service for the community. She brought a group of little children from New Orleans up here, for whom she continues to provide care. There are little ones she rescued off the streets. She gives them a home and cares for them like a mother, taking them to school and providing entertainment. The loud parties people talk about, that's just games they play with music and good food. I'll never understand how such wild stories about her got started. Maybe it's because she's rather secretive and hasn't explained to her neighbors. I've told her that being more open and friendly would help matters a lot. As we neared the store that day, we saw the rubber-tired wagon was parked under the big shade trees beside the store. The regal lady and her son were just coming out of the store with armloads of groceries.
"Hello there, Mr. Dunn," said Billy. "How are you all doing?"
"Fine, thanks, Billy," said Grandpa. "How are you all this fine sunny day?"
"We're good, Mr. Dunn, and I want to thank you for talking with Ma here. She's much obliged for the good advice that you gave her."
"Glad I could help, Billy. And to you, ma'am, I commend you for the help you're giving to those little children."
"Why, thank you, sir. I'm glad to live in this community and help these little ones. I'm thankful that you explained to the people at our last school board meeting about the noise and parties at my home. Some of the ladies have come to help me, and the children do benefit so much when we all work together."
Grandpa said, "Yes, when we all visit and discuss things, the whole community is blessed."
"Well, we better be getting along home, Mr. Dunn," said Billy.
"Yep, me and this girl here have some chores to finish at our house, too, after we load up with some chocolate drops and peppermint sticks," Grandpa said with laughter in his voice. Sugar Brown and Billy waved as they drove off in their smooth-riding, rubber-tired wagon. We never did get rubber tires on our old farm wagon, but all the walks and talks with my grandpa made up for that inconvenience. Through the years, we encountered Sugar Brown as she developed an orphanage and recreation area on her property for lots of children of all ages. Community spirit and happy gatherings
were often seen at our school and churches. Thanks to all our folks for the kindness and understanding shown to Sugar Brown in her efforts to develop a better life for herself and all the children she helped. Through Grandpa's foresight and good judgment, I learned tolerance and compassion, and especially not to believe or repeat unfounded rumors about neighbors. And this was The Legend of Sugar Brown by Doris Matlock. This next story is entitled Time of My Life. The spring formal dance was magic for this young woman. This was sent in by Sarah Etkin Baker. In the 1950s and 60s, middle school didn't exist, only junior high and high school. Our local junior high included grades 7 through 9, while the high school consisted of grades 10 through 12. At the end of my ninth grade year, I headed to Austin Junior High for its spring formal dance, a timeless teenage rite of passage of a sort, a dance heralding the beginning of our upcoming high school years. As I recall, the pre-dance preparations included getting my hair professionally done and finding the perfect dress, a cowl neck, silky yellow and white vertical striped dress. On the night of the dance, Dad surprised me with a yellow wrist corsage to match my dress. Before driving me to the dance, he tied it around my right wrist, saying, "You're a beautiful young lady. I am proud of you." He drove me this short distance to Austin Junior High and pulled up to the school's entrance. Then he did the most amazing, chivalrous thing. "Wait," he said, putting the car into park. He got out of the car, walked to the passenger side, and opened my door. "Have a fabulous time. I'll be here after the dance is over to pick you up." As you can imagine, I felt so ladylike and all grown up. I scurried toward the gymnasium where I found my friends waiting for me. Together, we pushed open the door to the gymnasium and gasped in unison. The dull, smelly gym we'd come to know had been converted into a mini ballroom. The bright overhead fluorescent lights had been doused, replaced with twinkling string lights. Purple and silver crepe paper streamers and balloons hung from the ceiling, and rock and roll music blared over the loudspeakers. For 2 hours, I had a great time dancing with my girlfriends, never expecting any ninth grade boy to ask me to dance. Then, just before the last dance, it happened. Ralph Buchanan, the ninth grade heartthrob, made his way across the dance floor and stopped right in front of me. Me, of all people. I just couldn't believe it. Would you like to dance?" he stammered. I smiled, nodded, and blushed. He took my quivering hand in his and escorted me onto the dance floor. I put my hands on his shoulders. He put his hands on my waist. The scenery and people around us dissolved as we swayed back and forth together in a circle for 3 minutes. The shortest, most magical 3 minutes of my life. Then the music stopped. The string lights were doused, and the huge overhead fluorescent lights flickered on, almost blinding us. The principal stepped onto the stage, picked up the microphone, and announced, "Congratulations, boys and girls. You are young men and women now. On behalf of the faculty and staff, I officially proclaim you high schoolers. Good night and good luck." A bewildered and speechless Ralph took my hand in his and ushered me outside, where Dad was waiting in his car. Then Ralph did just as Dad had done. He opened the car door for me. Although my legs felt tingly and a bit unsteady beneath me, I scooched inside, feeling much like Cinderella, who had just been swept off her feet by Prince Charming. Before closing the door, Ralph said, "Thank you for the dance. See you at high school. Maybe we'll have some classes together." "I'd like that," I replied, blushing once again. As Dad pulled out of the parking lot, he asked, "How was the dance? Did you have a good time?" "Oh, the dance was wonderful," I replied. I glanced in the rearview mirror to quickly catch a glimpse of Ralph in the shadow of the parking lot behind me. I had the time of my life. And this was The Time of My Life by Sarah Etkin Baker. Now this next story is entitled Making Hard Times Work. She knew early on that art would be what got her through. This story was sent in by Jean Watson. In 1933, I walked to Dundee Elementary School in Michigan. From the first day of school until the last, I loved every day and the teacher, Miss Terrell. One day I came home from school and saw my dad sitting on the front porch steps, crying. I said, "Dad, what's wrong?" It took him a long time to answer me, even though I kept asking him over and over. I was so happy thinking of school that I said, "Dad, I love school so much that I'm going to college to become a kindergarten or art teacher." He looked at me with tears running down his face and said, "That will never happen. I lost my job as Kroger manager today, and we won't have the money to send you to college." "Oh, I'm so sorry, Dad," I said, "but I'll get jobs growing up and put the money in the bank to save for college." He was feeling so low, he just shook his head and looked down again. 2 weeks later, he got a job to cut meat at the local meat market. He made enough to pay the rent and our bills, including food for our family, which consisted of me, my 2-year-old sister Joan, our mother Hazel, and Dad. Then Henry Ford opened the Dundee Old Mill building for a Ford waterwheel plant, and Dad got a job there. He worked for Ford until he retired at age 68. Dad also did so much for the small town of Dundee as a volunteer fireman. By that time, we were living in a house on First Street that Dad had bought in 1946. When the siren blew, Mom stood on the back screened-in porch holding his fireman's coat. Joan held his boots, and I held his fireman's hat. He would run out, grabbing his coat, boots, and hat on the way, and then jump into the car parked in the garage. Mom, Joan, and I always ran into the living room window to watch him leave. My first job was in fifth grade, when friends and I picked strawberries and put them in boxes to sell at the strawberry factory by the railroad in Dundee. We made 5 cents a box. My friend Barbara Carner and I also made cookies and different kinds of candy to sell at the Carner Farm Market on Saturdays. In sixth grade, during World War II, my friend Barb and I delivered mail after school, as the Dundee mailmen had been called to war. I made $1.65 an hour, the most ever, until after I graduated from high school. At age 15, I got my first summer job, babysitting for a 1-year-old girl every day. I made 50 cents an hour. All my earnings went into my savings account at the bank for college. One summer, I got a job at the hardware store, again, at 50 cents an hour. When I started at Eastern Michigan University in 1947, I had enough money in the bank to pay for college, but I didn't have any money for the dormitory. So the dorm president had me check in everyone on the third floor each night at 10 p.m. in exchange for my room rent. I looked for other jobs for my sophomore year. That's when the head of the art department asked me to work for him, setting up and cleaning up after each class. I loved that job. I learned a lot about projects and materials, and that knowledge helped when I started teaching. I kept to a budget to save for the next year and every year until I graduated in June 1951. My kindergarten dream came true. I taught elementary art for 35 years in Milan, Saline, and Wayne Westland schools in Michigan. Then 2 years at a Christian school, 10 years at my home, and 17 winters in an Arizona RV park. My husband taught oil painting after being art director for Ford Auto Shows for 30 years, and I taught watercolor. We enjoyed painting together and going to art shows. I also taught art projects to our kids and our grandchildren. And I'm still teaching today at age 94. Our great-grandchildren open the house door and yell, "Hi, Graham, what art project you got for us today?" And this was Making Hard Times Work by Jean Watson. This next story is entitled The Gumball Caper. His plan to be an entrepreneur landed him in the principal's office. This was written and sent in by Barry Davis. I was 11 years old in 1951 and attended sixth grade at E.C. White Grade School near the junction of Brookside Boulevard, Main Street, and 48th Street in Kansas City, Missouri. I had a job delivering over 500 newspapers to houses and 10-story apartment buildings in the surrounding Country Club Plaza area. I earned $12.75 a week. After putting $11 a week into a savings account, I still had money to blow. There was a penny gumball machine in Broadmoor's supermarket across the street from school. And among the many yellow, white, green, and red balls were yellow balls with red swirls that could be redeemed for 25 cents. My scheme was to insert 100 pennies, one at a time, and collect all the gumballs in a clean, empty, round, 2-quart ice cream carton. I surely would get 4 or more prize balls, and sometimes you could shake the machine and get 2 balls instead of one. I could sell the rest of the gumballs to schoolmates, 2 for a penny. I did end up with 3 prize balls and 108 regular gumballs. I got my 75 cents and was on my way to being an entrepreneur. Without thinking, I popped a couple of gumballs into my mouth on my way to school. And then, when I got there, put the carton containing the remaining gumballs under my desk. I still had the gum in my mouth when the teacher noticed I was chewing something. Now, we all had been told chewing gum was not allowed. The teacher asked if I was chewing gum, and I confessed. Under normal circumstances, I would have had to go to the principal's office, report the infraction, get marked up for it, and lose the gum. But this time, the teacher proclaimed, "If you're going to chew gum, you should share with everyone." Thinking I would get a reprieve, I immediately pulled the carton out and started passing out the remaining gumballs to my classmates. I had never seen such a look of disdain from a teacher. She grabbed my arm and took me directly to the principal's office, where I was promptly sent home with no gumballs. And this was The Gumball Caper by Barry Davis. Here's an interesting letter to the editor. It's entitled Tootsie Rolls for Breakfast, Lunch, and Dinner, sent in by John Slavic of Mountain Home, Arkansas. The September-October issue of Good Old Days showed a vintage advertisement for Tootsie Rolls. For years, I have passed out Tootsie Rolls to trick-or-treaters. To all the little ones, they would just be candy, but to me, they were once breakfast, lunch, and dinner. In December 1950, my unit was in heavy combat at the Chosin Reservoir in North Korea. The weather was really lousy with deep snow and temperatures of 30 to 40 degrees below zero. We were running short of 60-millimeter mortar shells, and a request for a lot more was put in ASAP. The code name for them was Tootsie Rolls. The next morning, the good old Air Force dropped several pallets for us, and when we went out to get the mortar shells, lo and behold, they were loaded with real Tootsie Rolls. Whoever received the order must not have checked the code book. Needless to say, we loaded every pocket inside and out with all we could carry. They wouldn't go to waste. We couldn't always make a fire to heat our sea rations or even to make coffee. This is when the Tootsie Rolls became breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Now, if you needed one real fast, you could choose one that was two or three layers of clothing closer to your body for warmth. They would be soft and melt quickly in your mouth. If you wanted one to last a long time, you would get one from an outside pocket. I wore six layers of clothing, and the Tootsie Rolls in the outside pockets were hard as rocks from the cold. I still keep some in my house, not for a meal, but just because I still love them. Thank you, Tootsie Roll Industries. Semper Fi. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.